Certainly not everything on Star Trek seems plausible, but when they would start an episode with the phrase "space, the final frontier," that, you know, that kind of really rang true. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. For many reasons, space has remained mysterious, and there's a lot still left to discover, to explore, and to understand. And the UW Geology Museum has a fascinating new exhibit that will help you and I understand a lot of what geologists, astronomers, and astrobiologists have been working on and what it means for understanding life here on Earth. And Brooke Norstedt is our guest. She's the assistant director of the UW-Madison Geology Museum. And Brooke, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm happy to have her with us today. And you are going to learn a lot, I think, as you visit with her and as you ask questions. Do you think much about life beyond Earth? What's not on Earth? Do you hope there's life in another universe? Why or why not? Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And maybe you've visited the UW-Madison Geology Museum. I'd love to hear what your experience has been with it as well. So you can join in with that too. And Brooke, let's talk for a minute about the UW-Madison Geology Museum. For those who haven't had a chance to visit, tell us about it.
Well, the museum actually was founded the same time the UW was founded. So we have been around, we are about to celebrate our 165th anniversary.
Cool.
And we have Wisconsin's first dinosaur to be mounted on display. We have rocks that glow in the dark. We've got impressive mineral and rock collections, lots of fossils from Wisconsin. So we're a free museum, so there's no excuse to not come visit us.
It really is a lot of fun. I know my daughter has walked around with her mouth open, jaw dropped at some of the things she saw there. And it really, some of it really is. And you have a very exciting new exhibit.
We do, yeah.
It's called Biosignatures, What Life Leaves Behind. And first, what are you talking about here with biosignatures?
Well, part of my job is to work with some of the researchers in our department. So the museum is nestled within the geoscience department. And I work with a team of five scientists at the UW, but they're a larger, they collaborate with people all across the country. And they have a grant from the NASA Astrobiology Institute. And this is an arm of NASA that was founded in the 90s to really start pursuing some of these big questions. Some of science's biggest unanswered questions are, you know, are we alone?
Yeah.
You know, when did life originate on Earth and how? And so since they're geologists, the bulk of the people I work with, they're really interested in looking at Earth's oldest rocks and Earth's oldest fossils and seeing how those inform our search for life in space. Because like you said, you know, there's lots of great sci-fi out there, but what NASA is doing is they're looking for microbial life in our solar system. Yeah. And they've got some interesting targets. You know, they're doing a lot of work on Mars right now. But these researchers, the work that they're doing is helping us think about what is it that we're looking for when we go to Mars.
So, we're a lot less likely to find somebody with two legs and two arms and...
Yeah, well, that would
two eyes or four eyes. we're talking about something pretty small,
tiny. Here. Yeah, so microbial life. We're looking at things that, you know, you wouldn't be able to see with your naked eye. Things that, you know, you would need a microscope to look at. And if it has existed on Mars in the past, how would we find out? You know, we haven't visited, we haven't sent people to Mars yet. That would be a one-way ticket. It's a one-way ticket for the rovers and landers that we send there. We haven't brought any Martian rock back to Earth. And so we have to equip these rovers with the right tools to analyze the rock there. And so we're looking for small clues that could be left behind in minerals and in the way that rock has been deposited. Really, the Curiosity rover that's there right now is trying to answer things like, were there habitable places in the past? So what is there a potential that life could have been on Mars in the past? It'd be an easy job if you show up there with a rover and a little green-headed guy pokes his head out over the next rock and says hello. So it turns out the task is a lot harder than that.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody's going to say, what the heck's the difference? Why are we worried here, or why are we studying astrobiology? What does it mean for life on Earth?
Sure. Well, it has, I mean, this is the job of a philosopher, right? To think about, you know, what are the implications if we do find life, or if we don't find life even? Those are, both of those answers have kind of profound resonance for people here on Earth, you know?
Yeah, I think I like the politician, I wish I could give him credit right off, but I can't, who has the Golden Goose Award. Gives out the Golden Goose Award, which is an award for researchers who have do sort of research that has no appears to have no particular bearing, and sort of a takeoff on the Golden Fleece Award that our former senator had, but just the opposite. This is something that really tries to highlight the importance of this kind of research.
Well, I think that, you know, it can seem like there's a lot of money being dumped into these sorts of questions, but there are, you know, all the money that NASA gets, there's a lot of practical application that comes out of it as well. And even just the scientists that I work with, some of them do work on these particular rocks called banded iron formations. And these are rocks that they've shown They're great accumulations of iron, and it turns out that microbes, these microscopic organisms, really were fundamental in the formation of these rocks. And these are the very rocks that they mine in northern Minnesota and all across the upper Midwest. It's why the steel industry was located where it is, and the auto industry is located where it is. And so all of those rocks that they mine, these, you know, bright red rocks, they are there because microbes helped concentrate them. And so, you know, the work that these people do, you know, has bearing on, you know, the structural foundation of Miller Park and Lambeau Field and the cars that you drive around.
And by the way, it was Congressman Jim Cooper, Democrat from Tennessee, originally conceived the Golden Goose Award. I think that's wonderful. Well, here we have this. We have some wonderful exhibit to talk, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But Dave in Superior is online. I want to give Dave a chance to join in. You can join us, too, with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Dave in Superior, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, you spoke about Wisconsin's first mounted dinosaur.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on where that's from and how it came to be in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, the specimen itself was not found in Wisconsin. We don't have dinosaur fossils that have been found here. This one was dug up in South Dakota, and it's the first skeleton to be erected, first dinosaur skeleton erected in Wisconsin. And so if that's what you were thinking, you're totally right to call me out on that. It's not a specimen that was dug up here. We have very old rocks in Wisconsin. The fossils that we find here are from when Wisconsin was covered by an ocean, on the order of, you know, 450 million years ago. And then we have a big gap. We're missing that rock record where the dinosaur fossils would be found. And then Wisconsin's covered by Ice Age debris. And so we find Ice Age creatures here as well, but we're definitely missing that middle part, much to the, you know, dismay of a lot of school kids.
There we go. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And speaking of fossils, Judith just posted a photo on Facebook, and not a picture of me. It's another fossil. So if you want to take a look at it, we'll get it up here. You and I are going to take a look at it, too, in a second here, but I'll get that up. You can join in again at 1-800-642-1234. Well, let's talk about the new display.
Yeah.
Tell
yeah.
us what's prompted this. And
well, so my job as part of the NASA Astrobiology Institute is to help translate the research that these scientists are doing to the public. And so we've done that in a variety of ways. In the museum, we pride ourselves on being a little quirky and trying to really, stretch the limits of what, public science outreach looks like. And so we've, early on in this 5-year grant, we sponsored an astrobiology night at the ballpark with the Madison Mallards. Mm-hmm. And so everybody who came through the doors got to learn a little bit about astrobiology and the research that these guys are doing. I had the scientists throw out the first pitch. And then we've also gone to music festivals on the east side during the summer and set up a booth and talk to people about astrobiology. So we wanted to take some of this work to places where you wouldn't just be getting, the people who are interested in science mm-hmm. coming to, but kind of the capstone of our entire grant is the assembly of this exhibit. And so what we wanted to do was really introduce people to, some of the specimens that are relevant. And so as part of this, we have Earth's oldest rock on display. It's a 4.03 billion year old sliver of rock from Canada. We have Earth's oldest fossil, which is a piece of stromatolite from Australia that's 3.4 billion years old. And really, what we're calling the exclamation point of the exhibit is that we have a piece of Mars. We were able to purchase a Martian meteorite. And it's one of...
How do we know it's a Martian meteorite?
Well, that's a good question. We know because the chemistry of the rock matches what we know about Mars. And so now that we've been to Mars and know a lot about mm-hmm. the rocks there, that we can match up some of the meteorites here as coming from Mars. Just like we have lunar meteorites. There are sure. rocks from the moon that have landed here, and we can match those up.
Very, very cool. And so you've got the oldest evidence of life on Earth,
mm-hmm.
pretty much.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And there's, and that's why we frame this as biosignatures. What does life leave behind? You can think about a lot when people think of fossils, they think of dinosaurs primarily, the big mm-hmm. bones, big skeletons, teeth. The farther back you go on the rock record, the harder it is to really definitively put your finger on something and say, there you go, that's evidence of life. It's even sometimes it can be stretching people's limits to, point at a little track of a trilobite or, even footprints of dinosaurs. And those are all biosignatures as well. But we're pushing that back and we were able to acquire some of these oldest pieces of life here on Earth.
Dick in Oconomowoc has a question. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. Great show. Where, in rough terms on campus, is the museum located and where's the spot for parking?
All right. So Dick wants to know, where are you located and how do you park?
Great questions, Dick. So we are located on the corner of Charter and Dayton. Our street address is 1215 West Dayton. If you know where Camp Randall Stadium is, we're two blocks east of Camp Randall Stadium. Parking, well, that's the number one question we get in the museum. So right now you can find parking underneath Union South, which has a parking garage beneath it. That's pretty much kitty corner from us. There's also Lot 17, which is another UW lot, and then some on-street parking options. You can check the campus map has live data as to how many spots are available in those parking lots.
And of course, to, for those people who say, well, where the heck's Charter? I don't know where Charter is. You actually have a website.
Yep. Yep. So you can just go to www.geologymuseum.org and you can find all that info there as well.
Mm-hmm. Brooke Norstedt is the assistant director of the UW-Madison Geology Museum. Great to have her with us. Join in with your questions and comments as we talk with her about biosignatures and what life leaves behind. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with Brooke Norstedt. Brooke is the assistant director at the UW-Madison Geology Museum, and talking with her about the great new exhibit that they have, that we'll have on display, and also about the permanent exhibits. They've got some wonderful permanent exhibits and a great place to go and spend a little bit of time. You may have some questions, and I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. What do you think about life not on Earth? Do you think much about that? You hope there is other life in the universe or not? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have a pretty cool photo. We'll talk about that. That's posted on my Facebook page. But first, let's go to John in Cashton. John, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is, how do you determine how old, how do you know it's 4.6 billion or this?
Yeah. Good question, John.
No, it's absolutely a good question. So, first off, not all rocks and not all fossils can be dated. But in particular rocks, igneous rocks, the ones that form from melted rock, so think of like during a volcanic eruption, the rock that comes out and cools. As soon as it cools, you effectively have a timer that's been set. And so the timer in this case is radioactive material that's inside. So there's radioactive elements within these rocks that decay over time. They're unstable and they decay into more stable, what are called daughter isotopes. And this decay rate is constant. And so if you think about having like an egg timer that you flip over, right, you can see the sand trickle from the top to the bottom. And the top is the parent material, that's the radioactive material, mm-hmm. and the bottom is the stable daughter material. And so by measuring the ratio of those two, if you have, you know, however much you have on the bottom compared to how much you have the top, however much daughter versus how much parent, you can calculate an age based off of that. So there's a number of different radioactive decay tools out there. A lot of people have heard about radiocarbon dating. You hear about carbon dating of specimens. Well, carbon dating is something that you can do on anything that's about 45,000 years old or younger. So you cannot carbon date a dinosaur bone because those are way older. And so you'd get a wacky date. If you tried to use this tool on that particular, you know, fossil, it would come up with a weird answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's 40 different tools you can think of in this toolbox of radiometric dating, and you have to use the proper tool on the proper object. And so usually when they're dating old rocks, they use a couple of different tools. They know that there's, you know, there's like uranium lead dating and potassium argon dating, and those two tools overlap in the age that they can give you for a particular rock. And so those help confirm and constrain the age for a rock. And so if you think about in Wisconsin, in southern Wisconsin, we have all of these sedimentary rocks that were laid down when Wisconsin was covered by water, but we're still able to put our finger on the fossils and say, oh, those are about 450 million years old. Even though we haven't dated that particular fossil, what we do have is in the rock with this fossil, there were nearby volcanoes that were erupting and laying down these thin layers of ash. And so we can look at those layers of ash and we can date those and we can determine mm-hmm. how old they are. And then what we call relative dating is we can say that fossil, if it's in between two layers of ash and we can date those two layers of ash, we can say, oh, the fossils in between those two layers are between those ages.
Yes and no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
there we go. Thanks,
One
Jeff.
More question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How did the rock from Mars get here? And then I'll hang up.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the rock from Mars, what happened originally is so this rock formed on Mars, and then about 700,000 years ago, an asteroid hit Mars. and knocked off a bunch of rocks, which have been spending the last 700,000 years in space. And in 2011, the particular Martian meteorite we have landed here on Earth. And if you think about all the Martian material that would be here on Earth, it would weigh about 300 pounds. So that's all the Martian meteorites that have ever landed here. It's about 300 pounds. And of all of that material, only five times in human history have people seen the meteorite coming through the atmosphere and landing, so where they've seen a Martian meteorite land. And this is the most recent one. So this happened in 2011 in Morocco. It was witnessed by some nomads that were out in the desert. And in Morocco, in all of Northwest Africa, there's a pretty strong meteorite trade because it's a desert. It's dry there. It's easier to spot meteorites. And so these people knew what to do, and they went down and they started collecting pieces that then went into the meteorite market. And we were able to purchase a piece from a collector in California. And it was really only through, his generosity too. He donated over half the value of the meteorite. We were able to leverage some gift funds and some NASA funds, but it was really out of our price range, and he was he was willing. He really wanted to see it in a museum. So,
That's wonderful. Thank you again for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we have listener Marie in Trempealeau has a photo. You should go to my Facebook page to see this. She found in her flower bed a coral fossil earlier this summer. She lives 3 miles east of Trempealeau. When the UW-Madison archaeologists were working in Trempealeau this summer, one identified it for me and said that it came from the Lake Pepin area and dated back about 400 million years. Would you be able to confirm? Probably not by looking at it. You wouldn't be able to confirm its age and origin. It's about the size of a half dollar, and she's thrilled to have it as part of her rock collection.
Yeah, excellent. Well, it passes my smell test from looking at the specimen on the Facebook page and knowing where it came from. That all sounds right to me. So that's absolutely, I would confirm that.
So it's a honeycomb coral fossil, mm-hmm. probably about 400 million years old.
Mm-hmm. That's all
wow.
about right.
Wow.
Yeah. And so those are, here in Madison and all over kind of southwestern and southern and southeastern Wisconsin, you can find really amazing sea creature fossils.
That is very, very cool. Your exhibit, again, we were talking about what's all included in some really old stuff here. When does it open to the public, and how long will it be in the museum?
Sure. Well, the exhibit opens to the public next Thursday, the 26th, and we wanted to align that with the Wisconsin Science Festival that's going to be on campus. It's a big celebration for 4 days, and so that's our public opening. And the museum we have no intentions of taking this down anytime soon. So we're considering it to be a pretty permanent exhibit.
Okay. So it will join the other permanent mm-hmm. exhibits that mm-hmm. you have. Mm-hmm. Going back to the exhibit itself, what goes into constructing and putting together something with this scope?
Well, I didn't have a real appreciation for that when I started this years ago. But it takes, really, when you start, you have to have a pretty good vision of what it is that you want to include and what you're not including and why. And then a lot of text writing, which is something that you have to think about in terms of, who's your audience and mm-hmm. what level of vocabulary do you want to be using? And so really we took a first stab at this, and we put out a lot of the specimens and had a lot of the exhibit text written and had that up, but it didn't sing until we brought in a graphic design firm to really mm-hmm. get people engaged in the content. And so We've been working with a local firm here, Cricket Design Works, and they have done a really phenomenal job. I've gone to them with a number of times when, you know, I've just been stuck. I've been like, ah, this is the only way I know how to describe this. And they say, oh, what about a cartoon strip?
Mm.
You know, and let's break it out in different frames so people can see what's going on. Or, you know, they've been really good at overcoming those obstacles. And so between, you know, getting specimens and really thinking about how to describe them and then convey that information to the public, it's a multi-year process for sure. Yeah.
A lot of fun, though. Pat in McHenry, Illinois, has a question for you. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I'm thoroughly enjoying the program. Our daughter graduated from Madison, and I never knew about the Geology Museum, so now this will require a visit back there.
Excellent.
My question is, your guest is very knowledgeable about geology, so I'm assuming you majored in geology in college, or if you didn't, what did you major in? Because it's very fun to hear your explanations.
Oh, thanks. I do have a couple of degrees in geology. I went to Gustavus Adolphus in Minnesota, got an undergrad degree in geology, and then got my master's here at the UW-Madison in geology as well. And I've always been back and forth as to whether or not I wanted to teach or if I wanted to, you know, well, I guess really what level I wanted to teach. And I was fortunate enough to find a home in the Geology Museum. So I find myself hearing squealing kids every day as they see the dinosaurs, and I get to talk to people about rocks and fossils all the time. It's a pretty good match.
Yeah. So yeah, well, all age.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Sounds like the perfect match for you.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call very much. Caller Nick heard that scientists cannot carbon date the Sphinx in Egypt. And he's wondering why. This may be one. I don't know if you can answer this one or not, but I'm throwing it out there for you.
Yeah, so well, the Sphinx itself is made out of rock, and I would suspect that the rock itself is older than 45,000 years, and so maybe that is the disconnect there, is that they can't use the radiocarbon dating is only good for things that are 45,000 years old or younger. And so they'd have to use something else if they wanted to date the rock, but that wouldn't necessarily inform you as to like when it was built, if that's what they're trying to discern. So I don't know more than that, really, about the Sphinx.
Chris in Saratoga, Wisconsin. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, my question goes back to microbial outer space life.
Yeah. Yes.
And I'm thinking of the Andromeda strain. I'm wondering if NASA or any of the space agencies have some type of quarantine of returning objects from space.
Well, that's a great question. There's a whole division at NASA called Planetary Protection, and they are interested not only in, you know, quarantining or how to take care of objects that would be returned to Earth, but also thinking about when we send rovers and landers to Mars, how do we prevent taking life there? You know, so they do the building of a lot of these, well, of all of the landers and rovers, they do in clean labs so as to prevent us transporting any microbial life to Mars and then, you know, discovering it.
Oh, sure.
Right. But part of the reason that there aren't really hard dates on when there would be any return missions from Mars bringing any specimens back is because, as I understand it, you know, bringing material back, that's a very expensive mission because getting there is hard enough, but then having to launch off the surface of Mars and get back to Earth is an entire problem independently. But then also having a facility. So it's definitely something that NASA has on their radar and is working on, but is expensive. And so these are things to keep in mind when you hear about governmental funding and, you know, supporting these sorts of agencies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris, for calling. Appreciate it. We got an email from Christopher. How would we detect life if it was not carbon-based? Has it been speculated if life could be based on another element in the same column of the periodic table, silicon or germanium?
Mm-hmm. So my quick answer to that is I don't know. but as I understand it, so NASA has limited funds and limited abilities. And so really what they've done with the NASA Astrobiology Institute is to focus their energy and resources. And so what they've said is we're looking in our solar system, we're looking for microbial life, and we're making the assumption that it would be carbon-based. And so, you know, while there's lots of people, I'm sure, even within NASA, who love to speculate and think about, you know, what other life forms might look like, you know, the focus of their research has to be constrained by those parameters. And even with the focus of microbial life, you know, a lot of people know about SETI. They know about the movie Contact with Jodie Foster. And SETI isn't even under the umbrella of NASA anymore. It's on their own. So that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And so the people who are listening for a radio signal or some kind of signal from space. And so NASA has really kind of reined in the parameters of the research that they can really fund and support right now.
And that makes, I guess that makes, I mean, if you had unlimited funds, that's one thing.
Sure, right. But there's even, I mean, within the research teams that I am privy to what they're doing, you know, since they're under the umbrella of the Astrobiology Institute, you know, there are teams that are focused beyond Mars. So they say, okay, we're going to Mars. We've been doing lots of work on Mars. What next? What are the next mm-hmm. targets in the solar system? And there's a lot of internal debate between a couple other destinations. Europa is an icy moon of Jupiter that a lot of astrobiologists are very interested in because it's a moon, but it has a rocky interior. And then it has an ocean covering a water ocean that's covering the entire moon. And then on top of the ocean is a sheet of ice. So it's all encased in ice. And this is a spot that a lot of astrobiologists are interested in because they wonder, well, there's liquid water there.
Right.
We, water is something we look for when we're looking for life. And so they want to go there and have some kind of hydrobot that drills down through the ice and goes down into that water and explores. There may be, who knows, there may be deep sea vents at the bottom of that ocean that may be similar to what we see here on Earth. We have these deep sea vents on Earth that have all kinds of interesting communities, living communities around them. And maybe there's something like that on Europa. And then Titan is another spot. It's a moon of Saturn. It's a moon bigger than our moon, a lot bigger than our moon, 50% bigger. And it has liquid methane and ethane on the surface. And so it's the only other body in the solar system that has liquid on its surface. It's not water, but it's methane and ethane. And the astrobiologists consider Titan to be kind of like a sister to early Earth. So when they think about what Earth may have been like early on in its history, Titan might inform that a little bit. And so in our exhibit, another thing we've done, a kind of fun thing, is we have an area called the Aromas of Astrobiology. And so we thought about some of these places and we said, what would they smell like? And we tried our best with the aid of scientists to recreate the smells of these places. And so we chose early Earth. So if you could time travel back 3 billion years ago, you know, in our planet's history, step out of your time machine and take a whiff. What would it smell like if you could travel to the bottom of the oceans?
What does it smell like?
Well, it's pretty stinky. it's a combination of ammonia, so think urine, and hydrogen sulfide, which is, you know, think
rotten
of volcanoes,
eggs.
Rotten eggs, and then another thing called methyl mercaptan, which is the same thing that helps skunks be stinky. So it's a combination of those three. The methyl mercaptan would be a byproduct of the microbes that were on the surface. They'd be churning out that stink. So the combo of those three is pretty stinky. The other two places we chose were the deep sea vents, which again, kind of rotten egg smell, pretty mm-hmm. pure there. And then Titan, which is this moon of Saturn. And that one, the atmosphere itself probably wouldn't smell, but there's dust all over the surface that contains cyanide. And that smells like bitter burnt almonds. And so when I've tested this with people, they like that one the best. They say oh, that yeah. one smells the best.
But that'll kill you just as fast. As
right, right. And so these, how I made these smells, it's not actually cyanide they're smelling. They're these little scent beads in there that are infused with smell.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's been a lot of fun. Though the first time I piloted that, it was at an event after hours at the museum, and I had just gotten these smell beads, and I was like, let's pull these out and have people smell them and help us construct these stinky scents. Turns out they were so overwhelming. The entire museum reeked that entire night. People would come in, and they were like, what's that stink?
So that's one that didn't work, but you've got a lot of things working over there now.
We do, yep.
Again, as we're almost out of time here, but repeat what, again, a little about the display.
Yeah, well, so the real highlights are we have Earth's oldest rocks, Earth's oldest fossils, and a piece of Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can smell these environments, and we also have a Winogradsky column, which is basically a giant test tube full of microbes. That we talk a little bit about microbial communities and how they operate.
And, of course, along with that, the normal permanent exhibits.
Absolutely. So we're the place if you want to see dinosaurs, if you want to see rocks glowing in the dark, if you want to see impressive minerals and rocks and other fossils from Wisconsin, we're the place to come.
And the cost of zero.
Cost of zero. We are free. So, and we're open Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30, and Saturdays 9 to 1.
It has been a real pleasure, Brooke. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm hoping you'll come back and be with us again.
I'd love it.
I would too. Brooke Norstedt is the assistant director at the UW-Madison Geology Museum. Talk about a lot of fun. She's a lot of fun, and the exhibit is a lot of fun as well. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of the questions here. Any information about phytoliths at the museum? Just one last quick one. Anything there?
Phytoliths? Nope, not on display.
Okay. Thanks, Brooke.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very, very much. A lot to talk about with Brooke Norstedt, and I really enjoyed talking with her. I hope you enjoyed listening, and I hope you'll stay tuned because our good friend, UW chemistry professor Bassam Shakashiri, has stopped by. We're going to talk about who the great science communicators are today. I think Brooke's one of them. And Bassam Shakashiri certainly is as well. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.